Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the March 9th, 2013 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Hey, it's time once again to spend an hour discussing what's new with the nation's space program, not only here at the Cape, but throughout the known galaxy. We've got another launch coming up. There's a comet in our sky. The space community is continuing to buzz about the idea of sending two people to Mars in 5 years. And daylight saving time begins tonight. Not that that has anything to do with our space program, but it's always good to be reminded, don't you think? We'll spend most of our time today talking with my guest, former ABC News space correspondent Jim Slade, a rare combination of gentleman and reporter who knows his stuff. Jim's experience dates back to Al Shepard's Mercury flight, and I've had the privilege of working with him during the past, more than 25 years. So between the two of us, we have more than our fair share of stories to tell. He'll join us in a few minutes to let us know what's on his mind about the space program. Plus, of course, we welcome your contributions to the program as always. If you have any questions about the space program or would like to offer a comment or something we're talking about, feel free to give us a call, the number 321-768-1240. Or if you'd prefer to send us a question or comment via email, the address to use is spacetalking@aol.com. All right, well, let's get things started by updating you on several space-related news events of note from this past week. First, when we talked with you a week ago, SpaceX had just launched its Dragon spacecraft to the International Space Station, and after several hours of troubleshooting with the thruster pods on the cargo ship, it was hoping to be berthed to the space station as early as last Sunday morning. Well, in case you haven't been paying attention, that's exactly what did happen. The third Dragon capsule to visit the orbiting outpost was safely attached to the Harmony node of the station early Sunday morning, and the crew has since opened the hatch and begun uploading the supplies of equipment inside. Dragon will remain at the station until March 25th, when it will be unberthed using the Canadian robot arm, and then re-enter Earth's atmosphere heading for a splashdown in the Pacific Ocean. You know, by the way, if you want to consider yourself a true space cadet and make fun of others who are less enlightened than you are, keep an eye out for anyone who uses the word docked instead of berth when talking about what happens to the Dragon spacecraft at the station. The correct word to use in this case is berthed, not docked. There is a difference. When a Soyuz or Progress vehicle flies to the station and makes an active, controlled approach to fly directly to the outpost and join with it, that's a docking. But when Dragon approaches the station, it flies up to within about 50 feet of the station and then stops so that the robot arm can reach out and grab it and then attach it to the station in a process that is properly called berthing. Now, knowing the difference helps make you a smarter space cadet and, among other things, allows you to smugly smile to yourself when you read headlines that wrongly use the word docking. By the way, Satellite Today, PC Magazine, the Britain's The Guardian, and the Brevard Times, even Space.com, all got it wrong last week. But many didn't, including Todd Halverson of Florida Today and Marcia Dunn of the Associated Press, both of whom expertly avoided the problem altogether and never used either the word docking or berthing in their stories or even in the headlines, which, of course, reporters almost never write. Anyway, now you know as well. Hey, next up on my update list, well, this past Wednesday was Space Day in Tallahassee, where the Florida legislature is now in session for this year. Space Day has become an annual event at the state capitol, which this year featured more than 30 participating companies and organizations and included the help of former astronaut and Kennedy Space Center Director Bob Crippen. Working together in teams, the entourage engaged in a full-court press to pay friendly visits to our state representatives and senators to remind them of the importance of the space program to the Sunshine State. Now, you'd think that would be a no-brainer, but even after more than 60 years of launching rockets from the Space Coast, there are still way too many folks in Tallahassee who believe that NASA and the federal government is paying for all of our space needs, and that space is just an issue for Brevard County that doesn't affect anyone else. Of course, nothing can be farther from the truth. You know, ignoring for the moment that millions of Floridians use space-related utilities such as GPS and direct broadcast satellite radio and television every day, the aerospace industry has a presence in nearly every county of Florida. And despite the end of the space shuttle program and, in my opinion, the senseless loss of thousands of jobs here in Brevard, aerospace still employs more than 30,000 people in Florida who generate $900 billion in revenue statewide. Now, reminding lawmakers of those facts was only part of the message for Space Day. The rest of the story that was told Wednesday to dozens of our representatives involved asking for support for a comprehensive agenda of issues that included full funding for Space Florida, further investments by the state to improve space-related infrastructure, and money to help pay for space-related research and jobs training. Now, another issue that is up for discussion this year, which I'm particularly supportive of passing, is a measure to restore 100% of the money donated to the Astronauts Memorial Foundation when Floridians purchase a Challenger and Columbia license plate. Now, for many years, AMF has had to split the fund 50-50 with the Technological Research Development Authority. But last year, the TRDA closed up shop following less than respectable circumstances, and now half of the license plate money is up for grabs. The sum is not insignificant, and in past years, there have been legislators who have lustfully eyed that fund with dollar signs in their eyes. I'm hopeful that won't be the case this time, and AMF will get the charitable contributions that rightfully should be theirs and should have never been taken from them in the first place. That money will help the Center for Space Education that AMF operates reach more teachers and students with new programs that will help ensure we have an inspired and trained workforce in place to handle the space programs of tomorrow, whatever they may be. Finally, I'm the first to admit that this Space Talk program tends to focus on launch and mission operations more than on space science and things of a more astronomical nature in nature. But when there's something new to see in our sky and there's no chance of it crashing into the planet and wrecking our day, even I get excited, and hopefully you do too. Right now I'm talking about a comet called Pan-STARRS. It was discovered in June 2011 and made its closest approach to Earth last Tuesday, missing us by a comfortable 102 million miles. It's now swinging around the sun and is at its brightest. Some of the pictures I've seen from Australia and other places have been absolutely spectacular. Astronomers say it should be visible to the naked eye through the end of this month, but it still will require a clear view of the western horizon, away from any city lights, and binoculars will definitely help you see the comet's double tail. Now, this Tuesday could offer a particularly striking view, as a very thin crescent moon will be in the sky, with the comet appearing just to the left of it, more or less. Look toward the western horizon just as the sun disappears, and then look for the moon. As the sky darkens, you should be able to pick out the comet. I really do encourage you to make the effort anyway to get outside and take a look. This is one time our flat state could be helpful, so go visit your favorite place to watch the sunset and take in the free show. By the way, we've got another comet heading our way later this year, and remembering these things can have a mind of their own and disappoint us, the 2013 holiday season might just offer us the brightest comet we've seen in the sky in a generation. So as the late astronomer Jack Horkheimer used to always say, keep looking up. Hey, with those updates out of the way, it's time to take our first break. When we return, we'll be joined by former ABC News space correspondent Jim Slade. And later on, we'll update you on preparations for the next launch from the Cape. All of that and more coming right up here. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in our program. You can also send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, growing up in Minnesota, as I've talked about frequently, I was one of those kids who stayed home from school to watch launches and moonwalks on TV. I spent hours and hours in the living room with the likes of Walter Cronkite, Frank McGee, and Jules Bergman telling me what was going on in space and, well, fueling my dreams of being a part of this great adventure one day. Years later, I had the privilege of working side by side with others who were and still are among the legends of the space reporting business, including the late Howard Benedict of AP, Jay Barbary of NBC, Bill Harwood of CBS, and the gentleman who was joining us by phone from his home in West Virginia, former ABC space correspondent Jim Slade. Jim, welcome to the program. How you doing?
Hey, Jim, I'm just doing great. I didn't know I was legendary, but I'll accept it because I feel that old.
Hey, your name's etched in brass on a wall at the KSC press site. What more can a guy ask?
Well, I guess so. Yeah, I had to take pictures of it so my kids would believe it.
That's about right. Hey, it's great to hear your voice. Jim, catch us up. Tell us, when did you retire, and what have you been up to lately?
Well, I've never really retired all the way, but I quit working actively in broadcast along about 2004. I ran my own little company for a little while, doing documentary work for the Air Force and for PBS and from other people like that for a while, and that was fun. And I did it basically for fun.
Yeah.
But I've always kept my space credentials, and I've always kept at it, and I keep writing about it, and keep an active hand and interest, and try to be influential where I think I can help.
Yeah. Well, let's keep this past, present, and future going chronological order. Talk about the early days of your career and how you got into space. I know you are as big as an aviation buff, a space cadet, and a propeller head as I am.
Yeah, I'm just looking at pictures of my little 1946 air coupe right now, which I'm having rehabbed with a new instrument panel, new wiring, and new upholstery. But we can talk about that some other time.
Yeah, really. But you are current still as a pilot.
Oh, yeah, very much so, and loving it still.
That's great.
It's the mental challenge that as you get older, if you have something like that, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I started down at the Cape. I'd been around airplanes all my life, virtually. And when I started to work for the old Westinghouse Broadcasting Company, back there in the very early 60s, I was one of the few people on staff that, you know, which end of an airplane pointed where.
Right.
And so they said, well, you know, we'll send him when the space program started launching people. And we got down there. We found out that it had very little to do with flying airplanes. It took the kind of people that fly airplanes, but not necessarily the way you do it.
Right.
And so there was a long learning curve as we got involved in it, and we came to discover that this may be a wide exaggeration, but not by much, that the engineers were only about a day or two ahead of us in learning what was going on. I mean, the theories were there, and it was all down on paper, and each day was an adventure in finding out if what was on paper was what would really work. So they would go out, and they would do their work, and then they'd come in and brief us. And we would find out that we were keeping up with them one day at a time, one day behind.
Yeah, you know, and with every launch, there was something new, and in the pace at which things happened was so quick. How did you ever stay on top of it when you're launching practically every other month?
Constant study and talking to the people who were doing it, and I still recommend that for anybody that's going to do anything in the field. You can't step in just because you've seen a launch from a distance.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And expect to know what's going on. And besides that, having a historical perspective on how things came to be the way they are today is really essential in doing that job.
Well, your job of taking and my job of taking the technical and taking all of that complexity and making it manageable that people can understand, and even your challenge, which is even greater because you don't get, you know, 12, 15, 20 column inches. You got 30 seconds.
Well, and not only that, and you're right. You and I were the middlemen. We were the translators for the public, and we had to, in order to translate it intelligibly, we had to understand it in great detail.
Yeah.
My handicap was that when I was on the air live, and as I am right now, I had no reference manuals I could use because I couldn't stop talking long enough to go look something
That's right.
up.
That's
I
right.
had to have producers in the background that could do that for me. And so, as a matter of fact, I had to be well enough schooled that I carry that stuff around in my head.
Yeah.
Rather than in my briefcase.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, you tell a story about being the guy that knew aviation and in space. I mean, my corollary to that is when I was starting in Florida Today as just a temporary sort of space guy to do a little research for him. This was back in 88. Discovery, Spatial Discovery's on the pad, and its Ohms pod started leaking.
Uh-huh.
And the editors start screaming in the newsroom, "Oh my gosh, the Ohms pod is leaking. What's an Ohms pod?
What does that mean?"
You know, and I pull the model up off my desk and point to it. And, well, it's a 6,000 plus three engine, and it's got, you know, hydrazine and nitrogen. Oh, you know all that? Yes, yes. Can you write it? Yes, yes. You know.
Well, that was the whole thing. One of the handicaps for you and me was that we knew the subject well enough that oftentimes when we came to the rescue and straightened people out on the latest scare that they thought they had seen, then they begin to think that we were minimizing it.
Right.
And what it really, really amounted to was that the technology was well enough known that the engineers could handle it in flow.
Right.
And you and I knew that, but the guy that was reading the wire in New York City didn't know that, and he tended to fall all over himself every time something happened. And that made life difficult, too. I remember Apollo 13, and it was bad enough as it was, but the headline writers in New York were tending to exaggerate every event and making it seem even worse than it was.
Yeah.
And so you and I had a constant battle on our hands, keeping a balance between reality and what the public was being fed once the story was out of our hands.
Yeah, it was so tough to make those calls. I remember when the night that Hubble Space Telescope's a mirror was discovered as to have a problem.
Yep.
There was a big powwow in our Florida Today editorial room, and the editors called me in and called my colleague Todd Halverson independently, and they said, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is Apollo 11 and 10 is Challenger, you know, where does this fit on the scale?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they wanted to hear that this was the worst thing ever. And I remember going in there and saying, you know, okay, it sounds bad now, but this can be fixed, and I guarantee you in 3 years it'll be working just fine. Well,
yeah.
They didn't want that. They wanted the sexy headlines. They
well,
wanted
that's right.
the big thing right away.
I mean, to keep people interested, you wanted it to be as dramatic as it could, so, and they tended to be overprotective of that. But the fact of the matter is, we had an editor in New York who went on the intercom. We had an intercom system all the way through ABC that everybody could hear at their desks all through the company, overseas and home. And he went on and said, well, this is awful. Hubble is a pile of junk. And then I had to, you know, go by back channel and get this guy by the scruff of the neck and say, no, it's not a pile of junk.
Yeah.
And it will be repaired. However, it's going to take some time.
Right.
So calm down.
Calm down. You know, I have a picture hanging on my wall at home of Saturn taken by Hubble that's just absolutely spectacular and beautiful, and everyone always comments on it. I say, yeah, it was taken by Hubble before it was fixed.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
You know?
When it was still nearsighted.
When it was still nearsighted. Jim, with about another minute and a half before our break at the bottom of the hour, talk a little bit about the technology and how it's changed. I mean, not only has our space program changed, but the way that we've reported it has changed, you know, and going way back when. I mean, how did you get the story out live from the Cape?
That was a book all in itself. Well, first of all, from what you and I knew during recent years, it was very primitive. It was a jungle. They had a press site, which was a mound surrounded by jungles full of snakes and all of the bad stuff that you find in jungles. Don't stick your arm in there, in other
words.
Yeah,
really.
We were about a mile and a half from the launch pad, and we tended to get kind of intimate with it. We had we pulled in old house trailers in there and hoped that the air conditioners worked. And when we first arrived in Cocoa Beach, the telephone company had four trunk lines from Cocoa Beach out to wherever the rest of the world connected. And in very short order, we built a big communication system simply because of our needs to get it out. The world was there covering it. If you want to know the difference between what exists today and what happened then, all you got to do is go to the block, Mercury blockhouse where Alan Shepard was launched.
And you see the big difference. Jim, stand by right there. We're going to
pause. I'll tell you more about that when we get
back. We're going to pause for our five-minute built-in hold here. Get you caught up on the news, weather, and sports. We'll be back with Jim Slade. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox open for your questions or comments. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@AOL.com. Former ABC News space correspondent Jim Slade calling us from his home in West Virginia. We're talking about the early days of the space program, Jim, and how do you get the word out from a press site to the masses in a day where we didn't have satellite trucks and microwave beams and wireless technology?
We had telephone lines, and we had audio engineers who knew how to hook it up and get a signal through it. And it may have not sounded as studio quality as you'd like, but it was pretty good.
So did you started with a camera facing you or somebody or the rocket, and so in terms of the television signal, did that transfer through the phone lines? Is that how it worked?
That was done by coax cable, yeah.
Okay.
We didn't have satellite transmission in those days. We were trying to build the vehicles so we could have satellite transmission.
That's so you could watch a rocket launch with a satellite. Yeah.
But before we went away there, I was saying what really struck me when I was down for the Shepard anniversary a year or so ago.
Yeah.
I went into the blockhouse and I looked at the old place, and of course that was pretty sexy stuff to me in those days. And I saw several things. I saw an old MagnaCord tape recorder, which was taking data.
Yeah.
I saw a huge, looked like a feed store scale in there that was being used to actually measure the changes in weight of the rocket as it sat on the pad, and you could see as the as it boiled off, you know, what looked like ounces being changed, and then it'd fill it back up. But the biggest thing was when you went over to the launch position, and there you saw an ashtray full of cigarette butts pulled out from the console and a red button.
Right.
And the guy mashed the button with his thumb, and the thing took off. Yeah. And compare that to the way it's done today.
Yeah,
with computers that work so fast that the human hand can't keep up with it.
Right.
And they actually do the countdown and the firing and all. But back in those days, by golly, when the launch director said, mash the button, Bubba, that's what they did, and off it went.
You know, it's interesting to get your perspective. You are something of an expert on the Wright brothers and,
yeah,
and the Wright Flyer, and I know that's a great love of yours. But to have lived your career and with your experience talking about the Wright brothers, you've watched from the Wright Flyer, not that you were alive then, but you know, the Wright brothers to Lindbergh to Mercury through to the moon, shuttle station, this progression that we've made, you know, I mean, other than the obvious milestones along the way, what stands out in your head about all this?
It's actually, truthfully, an evolutionary change in humans at an intellectual base. You know, all of this started seriously at the end of World War II with the V-2 rockets and the German scientists that came aboard.
Yeah.
When there was a division in aeronautics at that time. Some engineering interests stayed with the jets and the development into what we have today, and others branched off into the rocketry. And you have a definite why in the flow of the stream at that point in time. And both of those fed off each other. And then when you saw Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo come along, it took a little while for it to sink in that each incremental step, meaning each flight, was a learning experience that went up the chain to the next program as they went along. And that program that was being developed took that data and worked it in. Mercury, of course, was a single-seat ride to prove simply that the humans could actually endure it and ride it back to the ground safely.
Yeah.
Gemini, the two-man, which was to prove that you could maneuver, find another object in space, and dock with it. And that was docking, by the way, not berthing. And as Mercury and Gemini were going along, they were transferring their material laterally into the blooming Apollo program, which was being stacked up in parallel. And by the time Mercury and Gemini were finished, Apollo had been modified pretty successfully into what we know today. And it was an amazing thing to watch. And quite frankly, it went by so fast, we thought it was agonizing, but it went by so fast that it was really hard to get a grasp of it each and every day as you went along.
You know, today, the common complaint amongst us in the pro-space movement, of course, and one of the things that a lot of people say is, you know, we went from Al Shepard and Mercury to Neil Armstrong on the moon in basically 8 years. And now we're talking about, you know, the next time humans lift off from the Kennedy Space Center may not happen for at least another 10 years, if not longer.
I think it's disgraceful.
Yeah, how did we get here, or what do we need to do
we got to that point by taking it for granted. We have a political community that believes that, you know, that's all well and done, and we know how to do it, and we don't have to worry about that. Well, they're crazy, but they won't take that kind of advice.
Right.
If I had my druthers, and a lot of people do disagree with me, particularly, you know, since I was based in Washington all those years, a lot of the people that I confer with are there.
Yeah, and we pray for you all the time that you're stuck in Washington.
Thank you very much. Yeah, but I firmly believe that we were absolutely stupid not to keep two shuttles on active standby, fly them each at least once a year for crew experience and for technical experience on the ground. Because if you remember what the shuttle was built for, it was built to maintain a space station. That's
right.
The reason its cargo bay is shaped the way it is.
Yep.
And not to have a backup like that available when that amazing structure is in operation, the space station, 24 hours a day, not to have something that can actually take structural members up to it for repair, I think is absolute insanity.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Jim. And the way I phrase it is that it was stupid of us to retire the space shuttle program until we had the replacement capability ready to launch.
Goes without saying.
You know, whether it was shuttle or some new vehicle, absolutely.
And what really disturbs me is, yeah, the design for the new spacecraft is very nice. It's a fat Apollo, but it doesn't have wings.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, that's a mistake.
Yeah.
That you've developed that technology, and then not to nurture it and to use it. The Air Force is nurturing it and using it.
Yeah.
But to not keep it active, I think, is wasteful. It's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and it's the worst kind of governmental management you can possibly think of.
Spoken like a true pilot, absolutely, though.
How about that?
How about that? Well, let's talk about some of the things going on today, just to get your opinion. You know, it's kind of funny. As a reporter, we're supposed to be objective and unbiased.
Jim, the longer you do something, the more you know about it. The more your opinion is valuable.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Chet Lunner, I don't know if you remember Chet Lunner from the Gannett News Service. He's long since retired, but he taught me very early on. In fact, when I was still a reporter working for my college paper at Embry-Riddle, he says, you know, you can be in love with the space program and still report on it. Just like a sports reporter. You can love the game, but if the coach makes a bad call, you can call him on it. And space
exactly
is really
so.
No
you,
different
you
than that.
You care enough to say something about it.
And so we become experts in a way, and we have opinions, and you know, there are times to share those opinions, and certainly now is one of them. So let me ask you about some of the topics of the day, Jim, real quick here in our remaining moments. Let's talk about commercial space. Are you a SpaceX fanboy? Are you a musketeer?
Well, I, you know, it is what it is, and they are doing an amazingly good job taking the technology that we have all struggled so hard with all these years and making good use of it. Yeah, I see a place for it. I really don't much care for them transporting astronauts. I would rather astronauts transport themselves in a machine that they operate as much as the human can operate it.
Right.
If that's the way it's going to be, it beats the hell out of letting the Russians gouge us on a seat.
Yeah, and if humans are going to fly themselves, we get back to the winged aircraft that you were talking about, the winged spacecraft. Is it okay if it's a commercial spacecraft they're flying, or does it have to be a government-owned, operated NASA type?
No, sure. We lease cars, don't we? The government leases cars. That's okay. But I really feel better about a dedicated crew managing their own affairs, particularly in something as sensitive as the space program.
We've got about another minute here, maybe 30 seconds, Jim, for this. Your reaction to Dennis Tito and the Inspiration Mars Foundation announcement sent two people to Mars. Really?
Bull. Yeah, bull.
No That's technology, bull. No money?
And humanly, it's probably out of the question. You know, it's going to take a lot more than the few billions that he may be able to put into it to do something like that. And besides, they're going to land.
Yeah.
What's the point?
Is that Apollo 8, but not...
That's Apollo
8. You're going to go that far, you better land, huh?
Yeah, and sending two people, what good are they?
That's great. Jim,
How are they? Are they going to keep from killing each other?
Especially if they're married. Stand by, Jim, right there. We're going to take this little break here, come back, wrap up with our local launch forecast, and finish our chat with Jim Slade and pose our five terminal account questions to him. Stand by, everyone. This is Jim Bankey. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Bankey.
And welcome back, everyone, as we do begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with your reminder... Please stay in touch with us online throughout the week. You can use some of the more popular social media to do so. Of course, your first stop is online on the web, WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. There you can find links to an archive of our past Space Talk programs, text versions of orbital inclinations, and other good stuff from time to time. You can also follow us online at Twitter with the handle Space Talking. We have a Space Talk page on Facebook that you can like as well. And now let's take a quick moment and take a look at the local launch forecast. Our next space shot remains targeted to fly in just 10 days. A United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket is scheduled for blastoff on March 19th at 5:21 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The launch window extends for 40 minutes until 6:01 p.m. Riding atop the rocket will be a space-based infrared system satellite, the second of a new generation of missile warning spacecraft intended to replace the aging Defense Support Program constellation that has served our country so well for the past couple of decades now. The satellite was stacked this week atop its booster out at Launch Complex 41, completing the 401 version of the Atlas V rocket. This is the version that's sort of the basic model of the Atlas V. It has no solid rocket boosters and a single-engine Centaur upper stage. Pretty sight nevertheless. Once again, liftoff remains set for, again, Tuesday, March 19th at 5:21 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And you can be sure that we'll do our best to bring you live coverage of the launch right here on WMMB. For more information about these and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, including our upcoming Soyuz launch to the space station, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. Okay, on the phone with us today is Jim Slade, former ABC Space News correspondent, talking to us from West Virginia. And Jim, I just got a text message here from Bill Mick, who is our morning drive time person, morning drive time host of the Bill Mick Live Show here on WMMB, who happens to be from West Virginia as well. And he writes to me, how did ABC allow a hillbilly to have a microphone? How did Clear Channel Melbourne make the same mistake? Where does he live back home?
I live in Morgantown, and I got away with it by not having a West Virginia accent.
That's pretty good. Hey, you know, we talk about this Atlas V launch, and I was just thinking, you know, when you were covering all the launches here throughout your career, you know, I guess that from a national network perspective, the emphasis was always on, you know, the manned flights, the human space flights.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But did you ever get a good chance to make a case for the unmanned coverage beyond the occasional Viking and Voyager?
It was only for things like Viking and Voyager where they could gin up interest. They thought that anything that didn't have a human on it wasn't very interesting, and it was a hard sell. But when you could paint a romantic picture of this Voyager going out among the stars and the planets and taking close-up pictures, you know, we now have photographs of all of the planets in the system, yeah. Which is pretty remarkable all by itself. You know, when you could do that, then you could sell it.
Yeah.
And so those became a big deal, and we even went out to JPL to do a lot of the live coverage. And so, yeah, it wasn't every time, but when it was, we did
it
okay.
Took advantage of it. Yeah, you know, now this post-shuttle era, you know, every launch from the Cape is a big deal here locally, and in fact, we see it a lot more
of
national
course.
Coverage as well. Hey, Jim, okay, we got about 3 minutes to do this. It is time for Terminal Count, Mr. Slade.
That sounds
It's our feature at the end of Space Talk in which we will ask you 5 questions to get to know you a little bit better. This is not a quiz. There are no right or wrong answers. This is not a contest.
Ah, okay.
So please, no wagering. All right. Coolest rocket, Jim?
Coolest rocket, Saturn V.
Saturn V, hands down. How about the first launch that you saw, remember? Does it have to be Alan Shepard?
Yeah.
Yeah,
has to be Alan Shepard.
What's the most memorable launch for you, though? I mean, the one that you just love the best.
Well, Apollo 11.
I mean,
all of my career was aimed at Apollo 11 up to that time.
And did your clothes vibrate when that thing lifted off?
I was in a studio, and I stepped back from the window because I was afraid it was going to fall on me.
That's incredible.
I mean, it. If anything washed across you, it was the sound vibrations from the Saturn V.
I envy you that experience. There's no doubt
about
all of
them. So yeah. All of them go, and when it started to lift off so slowly, and as it picked up speed, as it burned off fuel, you knew that sucker had some place to go.
Did it look like it goes fast? Because all the film and video shows it so dramatic and slow, and then, of course, once it's in the sky, you don't get the perspective.
Because it's so big. That's a 36-story building. No, it did look slow.
Yeah.
You know, you kept – there was a moment there you kept going, is it going to get off the ground? And then it did.
And then
it picked up incrementally as it climbed.
What's your most prized space memorabilia that you own?
Oh, gee. I have contractor's models of every spacecraft I ever covered.
Wow. Wow. Very
so
cool.
They're sitting here right in my office right now. I'm looking at them, including the SR-71, which I consider the Blackbird, I consider a spacecraft.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We gotta make sure that we protect those models, don't we?
And then I've got one of the Kitty Hawk, Wright Flyer. It was only 66 years from that morning on December 17th, 1903, from the time they took off and flew 120 feet till the day we went to the moon.
I've been working on my Wright Flyer model, and I have sand from the liftoff point at Kitty Hawk that I'm going to mix into some acrylic and make it as the base. How about that?
Hey,
okay, best space-related TV series or movie?
The best movie was Apollo 13.
Yeah.
And there is no good television.
There is, except for when Jim Slade is anchoring it.
Well, you know, that's a long time ago.
That's a long time ago. Okay, Moon, Mars, or Beyond?
Moon, Mars, or Beyond. I think we need to go back to the moon and use it as our base for going to Mars, and we need to do that soon.
That's a great answer. Hey, Jim, we're out of time with you, sir. Thank you so much for taking time to share memories with us and get caught up. And
it's been a lot of fun, Jim, and next time I'm down there, dinner's on you.
Well, that's absolutely right. We'll charge it to WMMB. Hey, Jim, thanks a lot. Take care now, okay?
We'll see you.
There
Bye.
He goes. There goes Jim Slade, ABC, a class act all the way. Okay, next week on Space Talk, we're going to be talking about the Inspiration Mars Foundation effort that Jim Slade just called bull a few moments ago. Jeff Carr, who represents the marketing firm that's doing the PR for the effort, is going to be our guest on the show. He's been on the program before when he was with NASA, and we might even have one of the representatives from the Inspiration Mars Foundation itself. By the way, in 2 weeks, March 23rd, my guest is going to be former NASA astronaut Eileen Collins. First woman to pilot and command a shuttle and one of the inductees into this year's Hall of Fame. So don't miss that one. Again, Eileen Collins in 2 weeks. That is it for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks, as usual, to Sean Williams for manning the op station for the program today. Please join us next Saturday, at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck Program. I'm Jim Bankey, and we will talk to you again real soon.